KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on the Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Welcome to The Treatment, the home edition. It's always good to have people come back to the show, even if it's over a decade later. The last time my guest, Academy Award winner Barry Jenkins, was here, he was making movies in sort of black and white. He's now moved into the most vivid color imaginable with his Amazon adaptation of Colson Whitehead's The Underground Railroad. Barry, first of all, thanks so much for being here.
Hey, thank you for having me. It's good to be back. I assumed I was here for Moonlight, but man, Medicine of Melancholy, that's a deep, deep dig there.
Talking about Moonlight and medicine, one of the things that I find fascinating about this and also the way you work that I think is peculiar to you is that you are always aware of the color spectrum when it comes to people of color as anybody I know and how will we react to that. What I mean by that is that there's so much red in this. I mean, more red, I think, in the first episode, in fact, than you used into your entire career up until then. And I think you're so aware of the visceral power of the color red and how it makes people react to people of color that I was immediately struck by just your mastery of it.
It's interesting you point that out because in Medicine for Melancholy, we shot the show. If you look at our raw data, it's entirely red because we knew we were going to desaturate the image, but we wanted to retain, even in this black and white prism, some warmth in the character's skin. In the first and last episode, this idea of red, these very warm tones were very important, both, you know, in the wardrobe, but also, yes, reflected in the character's skins.
But also, too, the way blood is used in both, as you mentioned, the first and last episodes. I don't want to give too much away for those who haven't seen the last episode, but there's a reflection of the way red is used in the first episode.
Ms. Simone says blood on the leaves, and we have blood in the soil here in this show. Yeah, you're right. I think within the first 20 seconds, the first image you see that isn't Cora and Ridgway falling, it's blood hitting the floor. Yeah.
Yeah, I've always been struck by this, the way you use the colors red and blue in terms of their powers to soothe and provoke. And I just want to talk to you about color palette for a minute because you're incredibly aware of that. And I also find myself thinking of the way you use sunrises and sunsets.
Yeah, I mean, we filmed the show entirely in the state of Georgia, and we filmed it primarily in the winter, fall into winter. And so this sunrise and sunset, it was impossible to make the show without capturing every single second of the daylight. For me, it was interesting because from the fall to winter solstice, the sun rises in the east, but it rises from a point farther and farther south. And so if you're standing anywhere, especially as these characters in the state of Georgia watching the sunrise, you are looking towards the motherland. And there was something about that resonated with me.
Yeah, because I guess I find myself thinking about characters trying to find where they're standing in literal and metaphoric terms, working so much as a part of the book. Mm-hmm. And that seems to be happening here, too, trying to figure out where the plants themselves in the room and which way they should be standing and that perspective.
Yeah, and it's interesting because sometimes Cora is trying to decide whether she will plant herself or not. So much of her legacy is tied up in this plot, and she's carrying these seeds. And yet she arrives at a different state. And, you know, we decided in the writer's room that she is manifesting these places. You know, she gets to North Carolina and there is a block because she's not ready to leave behind the thing she's left behind in South Carolina. So it was one of those really meta layers of the narrative that, you know, for us, when I say us, I think myself and James, then also all the writers in the writer's room, was really fun to play with those things.
I guess I was wondering, and you must get this question a lot, if Colson had seen Remigration, because I couldn't help but think about that as I was watching this.
You know, it's funny. I don't think that he had seen Remigration. And, you know, that short film, which I made for ITVS's Future States anthology they were doing back in the day, these short films about a speculative future. And that was at a time, as you said at the top of the program, where I was living in San Francisco and wondering, what is going to happen to all the working class people of the city, the impoverished people of the city 10, 15, 20 years from now. And here we are 10, 15 years on from making that short film. And yeah, a lot of the prophecies in it are coming true. it's interesting because that's the only thing I've made that set in the future, from Medicine to Moonlight to Bill Street to this. I've been working deeper into the past. But I do think that film, if there's anything Afrofuturistic about it, I think there's also these Afrofuturistic principles in the Underground Railroad as well. But I don't think Colson had seen it.
Yeah, because I was struck by that, because it felt so much of the same tenor to me. And even though there's probably like a 5 or 6 year gap between the publication of the book and Remigration, it felt like you guys were vibing in so many similar ways.
Yeah, I think whenever you're trying to game out or spec out or reason out, you know, what is going to come of the lives of Black folks in this country, in America, you know, and how is America going to rise to meet the challenge that it's created by enslaving Black folks? Is it going to rise to that challenge? I think whenever you're sort of reasoning that out, whether through speculative fiction or alternative history, you kind of end up working towards some of the same goals, some of the same principles. And I think it's interesting arriving at Valentine Farm, both in the book and in the show, you can see some of the things that the characters in Remigration, both in their past and in the future that the government of San Francisco was theoretically offering them. I think some of those same conversations, those dialectics are playing out.
It's interesting too, because I guess I find myself thinking about the Santana, you know, those who can't remember the past are condemned to repeat it. And for those of us, people of color, we don't have the luxury of not remembering the past, because we have to ask ourselves where we are, because at some point it will repeat itself on us. That's something that you've kind of visited in everything you've done, people's relationship with the past and that idea of repetition that's forced on people of color. I mean, it's even extant to some extent in Beale Street.
Yeah, and it's interesting, too, to have this idea of memory. There's intellectual memory, and then there's emotional and spiritual memory as well. I think the history of Black folks in America hasn't always been recorded or articulated in the journals and in the letters, and certainly as a public school kid, and the textbooks that are designed to teach us that history, and yet the memory of them and feeling and emotion and spirit, that is undeniable. And it's why, you know, when we're making these things, especially this one, and Colson gave us this great gift, this is alternative fiction. You know, he likes to say, you know, it's a very truthful representation of the history of Black folks in America, but it's not fact-based. I mean, I think in the same way, when we're making these things, we're trying to have an emotional truth, not necessarily be limited to a factual truth, you know, this retelling of events.
God, there's so much, because that sort of schism about the emotional truth versus the real truth. I just found myself, as you were saying that, thinking about that moment in episode 2 where Mr. Henry is teaching somebody how to use the bullwhip and Cora's reaction to that. And just, I mean, that idea for you, that memory and the tactile and the visceral power of memory is always a part of the way people lead their lives and the things you do as a filmmaker.
Yeah, and what's shocking about that scene to me is, yes, watching him create the spectacle, it is very clearly giving her this visceral PTSD. It's taking the post out of the PTSD and making it very present. And yet, I look at him also, you know, which is the whole museum is designed to recontextualize that history and make it something very sweet and very docile. And yet once he starts performing the truth of that history, it comes out, it reveals itself. And I think this is how so much of this history, again, talking about this idea of memory, of how it plays out. And sometimes when we get these images of policing of the rule of law run amok to the detriment, to the destruction, to the death of Black lives, we're also seeing, just like in that scene, where this history revealing itself unbeknownst to the perpetrators of this violence.
Yeah, because it's an actual distance to them. They can do something like that, wield a whip, and it has no kind of racial memory for them, or not in the way that we experience it.
It has no racial memory, and also, too, that there is no memory of it, because I create the narrative. I create the images of what this history was. You know, I've been creating it every day. You walk into a classroom and have to read this textbook that tells me about the migration of Africans into America and the work they did here building America, rather than referring to these things in a very truthful way, or hell, an even more fact-based way of what they actually were.
You work so interestingly for me in extremes. And the extreme that often exists in your work and very much is present in Underground Railroad is that sort of gap and proximity between cruelty and considerate. You know, and that's a moment that we're talking about where that happens, where somebody's trying to be very careful about creating this thing and completely unaware of the repercussions of that violence.
Yeah, in my research and in Colson's research as well, some of which he shared with me, that was what it was, man. That was what it was. And then being in the state of Georgia, filming this and sometimes standing in spaces where these things happened, where I'm surrounded by trees that were there to bear witness to some of these atrocities that we were recreating, the natural resplendent beauty of these locations would be ever present and always affirming itself. And then on a moment's notice, you know, these acts of horrendous violence, mm-hmm. of outrageous brutality would coexist side by side. And I do believe that was, again, not fact-based, that's a truth-based representation of what it was. I didn't create this beauty. I didn't bring these things here. You know, I just happened to be in the spaces that these things took place, and this is what it is.
But as I saw that moment again, I just find myself in watching this flashing back on so much your work. I mean, the moments in Moonlight between mother and son where she's not aware. Mm. I mean, that moment of trying to be considerate, but a complete miscalculation of that. Now that can be care for one person and cruelty for somebody else. Suddenly we see something in Beale Street as well. I mean, that almost absurd distance and proximity between those impulses fascinates me that you keep returning to that.
Because it fascinates me as well. And I think also too, when you have these things in relation to each other, I think their existence makes more sense to me at least, because I don't think anyone's experience is all one thing. I think the tragedy of life sometimes is that, you know, there are people for whom life is incredibly difficult. And yet maybe every now and then you get a taste of this other version of life. And there's this imbalance between people who have access to one experience and people who are forced to live their entirety in this other existence. And so I think having a work of art or, you know, an essay or an interview that can house both things, I think is always a bit more truthful of what life really is.
Yeah, I mean, I see that stuff, though, in your work, and I find myself thinking about that peculiar absurdity that you see in somebody like Hu Hsiao-hsien, who does this sort of thing, too, where we're watching something happening in real time and seeing how mm-hmm. that prism that separates us makes it one thing for one person and something else for the person who's the recipient of the act.
Yeah, I mean, the good thing for us, I'm talking of myself and James Laxon, the cinematographer, and Nicholas Bertel as well, is we always treat, whether it's light or dark, good or bad, we kind of treat it with the same sort of approach. You know, I'm reminded of in Moonlight, you know, one of my favorite shots is when Andre Holland, as the character Kevin, he sets a pot on the stove to make tea, and we just cut to the shot of the pot just waffling, you know, on this rickety stovetop. And there was just something as romantic about that, as beautiful about that, you know, as these two boys resting their heads on each other's shoulder for the first time. And I think because of that, sometimes, as you're referring to, you know, these extremes, they can coexist. I think because we're approaching them the same way.
It's funny you mentioned that end of Moonlight, because I find myself thinking about, and I don't want to give too much away for those who haven't read the book, even though it's kind of different, or seen the entirety of Underground Railroad, that moment of respite that you're talking about, mm-hmm. That you build to, happens here too.
Yeah, it does. And you know, maybe someday I'll give people an ending where, you know, the main character does a dance and gets the job and strides triumphantly towards the sunset. But I just can't get away from, again, the truth of what these characters' journeys is going to continue to be. Which is always really important for me because, you know, there was this wonderful review of the movie that came out by this critic, Angelica J. Bastian, I believe. I don't want to butcher her name. Apologies, Angelica, for Vulture. And she wrote about this notion of Cora as a cipher, the main character. I thought that was really, really interesting. You know, I think Cora is a very embodied individualist person, but the idea of her as a cipher doesn't bother me at all. Because if she is, then in a certain way, she is us. And you and I are both Black men living in America with a reasonable amount of success. And yet, you know, someone broke into my garage a couple of weeks ago, and I had the option. I was trying to file a report just because the stuff they took out of the garage was insured. You can't claim the insurance without a police report. So I call. It took me forever to get somebody on the phone. By the time I did, it was dark. And the dispatcher was like, oh, we can send someone out. And Elvis, I swear, I thought about it. I said, you know what? No, I'll call back tomorrow morning when the sun's up. And I had to make that choice. And so is Cora going to get to stride down Main Street again? She did it in South Carolina. And what happened? They pulled a rug from underneath her. And so I think the ending of the show has a fidelity to that experience.
As we talk about the moment of needing respite, we're going to take a little bit of a break. My guest is Barry Jenkins. It's always good to have him back. It's been way too long. His newest project for Amazon is the adaptation of Underground Railroad. It's a treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes. Join Jacqueline Coley as she hosts a brand new podcast, Scene on the Screen. Meet the innovative people at NBC Universal as they share their journeys, inspirations, and the movies that define them. Each episode is an intimate and fun conversation about the impact of film. Scene on the Screen is available now wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment. My guest is Barry Jenkins. The new project is, and I forgot the article, The Underground Railroad, the adaptation of Colson Whitehead's amazing work. It's an astonishing piece of work for Amazon. And it's something that's really interesting about your work that really plays out in a fascinating way here is given how much tension and anxiety there is in these tableaux that you play out, I always get a sense of breathing of you taking the time. It feels like in some ways to me a Southern thing, and there's really that time to breathe here, but I actually really feel that the pace is faster.
I think the pace is faster because there's more plot, you know, but again, the same way we approach the both the brutal and the romantic things with the same aesthetic, I think we approach the plot and the story with the same aesthetic. So I think there's more plot is maybe why the pace feels faster, but I don't think there's anything different about the way we made this show than the way we've made the things before. I mean, I'm happy that the pace feels faster. It's an epic journey. I mean, she does cover a lot of ground, both literally and figuratively, both geographically and emotionally. And so because so much ground is covered, it should feel, there should be a pace to it. But that wasn't intentional. I don't think there was anything different that we did in this show than what we've done in the previous films. This space you're talking about, I don't think it's about being Southern. I think that's just about, you know, when as you and I talked about before, when I started studying cinema, you know, it was Claire Denis and Wong Kar-wai and Lynn Ramsey. And I think in the works of those filmmakers, the pace is dictated by the story. It's dictated by the character. And I think there's something really effective. I think it allows the audience to really see the character and to really see these very minute evolutions that the characters are making. So I think that's how real life takes place.
Well, it's interesting, too, because in there are a few episodes, and I don't want to name them just again, not to give things away, but you offer a lot of material really quickly, and then there is almost a clearing kind of breath that happens or a kind of a space that happens so then we can take everything in. Because to get back to what you're saying, quoting Angelica Bastian, I think what you're doing is kind of giving us a chance to catch our footing as Cora is kind of the audience surrogate, who I do think she's incredibly empowered. And I'm aware of her reacting to everything. I mean, I'm and it's that for me, that really carries it, that we're aware of her, that split in her between the head and the heart, which exists in so many of your characters too, and how they're going to react, whether they're going to react emotionally first or with their heads first. And I feel like that's where this comes from, you know, this idea of really grounding her as an audio surrogate in a way that we've not had from you before.
I agree with that. And it's interesting because we've been talking about Moonlight a bit, and I haven't talked about Moonlight in relation to the show very much at all. But Moonlight has a very deliberate structure, you know, which is we're building this character. He's a kid, he's a teenager. And then we start off the first section of the last chapter. And now it's like, and he's this and he's that. And then once he pulls up at the diner, now we have one of the longest shots in the film. And then he walks all the way to the diner and the doorbell rings. And now time is being revealed in a different way. I think the first three episodes of the show kind of function the same way. I mean, each one of those episodes, there's a lot of story, introducing a lot of characters. And then once she hits Tennessee and she encounters Jasper, now here's the lesson. Because this character, Jasper, is almost like this, I don't know, he's like an apostle or prophet, you know, that Cora has been fated to spend this time with. And to a certain degree, again, no spoilers, but you know, I think maybe Jasper's last breath is Cora's first breath, you know, and is why we cut them the way we do. And time, again, you talk about breathing. It's not that it's Southern, but, and now she's learning to breathe again. And slowly, as we ramp through the remainder of that episode into the next one, you see her. She's gaining strength, gaining possession of herself. And then once we get to Indiana, now we're back. You know, it's fun. I was doing this podcast with Larry Wilmore. He's a really smart cat. He's talking about the difference between plot-driven stories and story-driven stories. And he used Spielberg as an example. He's like, Raiders of the Lost Ark is all plot, very little story, because Indiana doesn't change over the course of Raiders of the Lost Ark. But then you get to Close Encounters, and Richard Dreyfuss, not a lot happens, but he evolves so much that choices he's making at the beginning of that film are totally different than the ones he's making at the end. But not a lot happens, you know, between the beginning and the end of that. I think in this show, we start off with the first plot, 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 plot. Then you get to that middle section, and now it's just the story of this woman. She knows who she is. She's made this choice. She's in the repercussions. But oh my God, look at how much she's growing. Yeah, so it's interesting. I think the way Moonlight develops, the same way the show develops, but over a much longer period of time.
Yeah, right down to the thing we talked about before, that I think you said it shocked you when I noticed this, that Moonlight in effect takes place over the course of a day.
Yeah, effectively. Especially that the last chapter, yeah, it takes place over the course of a day. And Cora's radical evolution takes place over the course of this one trip across Tennessee.
What's fascinating about your movies, too, is that I'm not aware of time in them until the film is over, and I think, or the project. So I think, well, this is very specifically sort of has correlations to a clock or a calendar, because you're charting somebody's growth. Because I think the way you work is it's almost always about telling a story of an emotional evolution or somebody not noticing their own emotional evolution. If we go back to medicine or what you're doing in Remigration, which is about the world moving around these people and them deciding if they're going to move with it or not. I find myself thinking about that being the clock, really. And I always feel like there is a ticking clock in your work, but it's a clock of the investment we make in the protagonist. Is that person going to be able to evolve in real time to what's going on around them? Does that make sense?
Definitely makes sense. And it's interesting hearing you describe Cora in that way, because that's who I'm applying this conversation to. And I think that that is the case, that does ring true. You know, it's interesting. We shot the show so out of sequence. We began South Carolina was the first episode. Then we filmed Georgia and Mabel. Then we did the two Indianas, then North Carolina. And then we finished up with all the Tennessee work. So for Tuso, that's such a wild bit of calibration. But I do think, you know, she starts off the show with someone who doesn't want to be seen. You know, she wants to close everyone off. You know, I have these female friends who joke with me, if a man who looks like Aaron Pierre comes and asks me to go anywhere, there's no way I'm going to say no. And I go, yes, but she doesn't see anything. She's so bitter and angry, as she should be, justifiably so. And then you see this evolution, whether it's through her experience mothering and protecting the character Grace, and then into closing off and then opening herself up, opening her heart to the character Royal. I think you do see this process you've described of a character evolving to the point of self-possession. And I think Tuso did a great job at that.
It's The Treatment. We're talking to our old friend Barry Jenkins. His new project for Amazon is the adaptation of The Underground Railroad. I mean, I see so much of all of your work in this. I know we've talked a bit about Moonlight, and that's partially because I didn't get a chance to talk to you about it here. But also, I see that question, too, that we got in Beale Street, which is, how is she going to react to this world that's going on around her? Which involves, again, the question of the threat to Black masculinity around her, raising a life that's growing inside her, and what she's going to do with all that. And, you know, this idea of asking these kinds of questions of Black women in pieces like this, I feel it still feels to me like a radical act.
Yeah, and I'll say, you know, all praise to Colson Whitehead, the two-time Pulitzer Prize award-winning Colson Whitehead. You know, when I first read this book, the conceit of the Underground Railroad grabbed me, yes. But oh my God, the story of mothering that was told through this character, Mabel, in Cora's dislocation, disassociation, disembodiment, because she doesn't have the biography, because she doesn't have the information of what's caused the separation between her and her mother. That was the thing that really just grabbed me about the book. And almost this tribute to Black women and Black mothering, you know, as exhibited through the lives of Mabel and Cora, it just really grabbed me. And I thought it was something that was very important to nail in the telling of this story. Now, then you hire these actors, and the actors come in and give body to these characters. And it just went to a place that I couldn't even imagine.
No, I just found myself thinking about these dramatizations of Black mothers. If we have Beale Street and Moonlight, and now this, I mean, I just found myself thinking it's really an incredible expanse of that emotional experience and how different it is. I mean, what you're doing in so many ways is in your work, and it goes to what Baldwin did in Beale Street and what Colson does too in Underground Railroad, is presenting archetypes to make us ask questions about the way they've been presented to us as people of color, and also to make people in the mainstream ask questions about these archetypes too.
I agree. And what I'm thinking of right now, listening to you, is, you know, we put out this piece called The Gaze before the show came out. And it's just the series of these images of some of our principal cast, but also our background actors, these tableaus of them. And there were quite a few of them where there is a couple, there's a man and a woman in the same shot. When you watch those shots, the women, the Black women, they just take those shots. You know, there's two sets of eyes. You could focus on either one, but every time the Black women, it's almost like, and usually the man is taller than the woman. The man is physically larger than the woman. And yet the woman is the one who's holding the shot, who's grounding the shot. I think to me, that's emblematic of, I think, the role that Black women have played, you know, in the lives and the surviving, the thriving of Black folks in this country since its inception.
It's so interesting, too, that you've offered these very different takes on that experience of motherhood, but also at some point in all of them, the anxiety of what am I going to do about my child and how that plays out in so many different ways. I mean, that's really, to me, an incredible thing to see played out, to see dramatized in ways that feel, not just feel, but are incredibly different in each instance.
I'm glad you used the word dramatized, because these are dramatizations, but I think they're rooted in, you know, they're very truth-based and probably fact-based, but we just don't have so many of these stories have been lost to the historical record. And yet I think we can all look, you know, in this place or that place, and we'll find a story of one of these women who did the work, who probably, unfortunately, who lived the sacrifice. I think it's very important to point that out. That has allowed, you know, folks like you and myself to sit here and have these conversations about works of art that we've created in their image.
It's always so great to talk to you, and I'm sorry it's been so long since you've been here. Please come do the show again. We can talk about your shoes next time. I'll talk about mine, too. I'm wearing a pair of George Cleverleys right now, if it makes you feel any better. My guest is Barry Jenkins. His new project is The Underground Railroad for Amazon. A recording engineer who's part of our terrific production staff is Kat Yorosh, who was often joined by Paul Smith and Desmond Taylor. The show is edited and produced by Rebecca Mooney. To better days and better shoes, everybody. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment. Catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or if you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on the Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.